19, 20, they buy impossible real estate in New York, Hollywood, London. They set themselves up as a new Medici class, drawn to the urgent throb of the future. They are something beyond hip, collectors of genius, winging from Davos to Coachella to Sundance, taking meetings offering today's artists, musicians, and filmmakers the seductive ego stroke of cash and the prestige of their company. Beautiful and rich, they don't take no for an answer. Leslie, Layla to her friends, was one of the first, her mother a former Galliano model from Seville, Spain. Her father invented some ubiquitous high-tech trigger found in every computer and smartphone on the planet. He is the 9th richest person in the world, and even with only 1/3 of her inheritance vested, Layla Mueller is the 399th. She has so much money, she makes the other rich people Scott has met, David Bateman, Ben Kipling, look like working stiffs. Wealth at Layla's level is beyond the fluctuations of the market, a sum so big she could never go broke. So great that the money makes its own money, growing by a factor of 15% every year, minting millions every month. She makes so much money just being rich that the annual dividends her savings account earns make it the 700th richest person on the planet. Think about that. Picture it if you can. Which, of course, you can't. Not really. Because the only way to truly understand wealth at that level is to have it. Layla's is a path without resistance, without friction of any kind. There is nothing on earth she can't buy on a whim. Microsoft, maybe. Or Germany. But otherwise. "Oh, my God," she says when she enters the study of her Greenwich Village home and sees Scott. "I'm obsessed with you. I've been watching all day. I can't take my eyes off." They are in a 4-story brownstone on Bank Street, 2 blocks from the river. Layla and Scott and Magnus, whom Scott called from the Navy Yard. As he dialed, Scott half pictured him still sitting in his car outside the gas station. But Magnus said he was in a coffee shop putting the make on some girl and could be there in 40 minutes, faster, once Scott told him where he wanted to go. If Magnus was offended at being ditched before, he didn't say so.
"Look at me,"
he tells Scott after the housekeeper lets them in and they're sitting on a sofa in the living room.
"I'm shaking."
Scott watches Magnus's right leg bounce up and down. Both men know that the audience they're about to have could change their artistic fortunes irrevocably. For 10 years, Magnus, like Scott, has nibbled at the fringes of artistic arrival. He paints in a condemned paint warehouse in Queens, owns 6 stained shirts. Every night he prowls the streets of Chelsea and the Lower East Side looking in windows. Each afternoon he works the phones, looking for invitations to openings, and trying to get on the guest list for industry events. He's a charming Irishman with a crooked smile, but there is also an air of desperation in his eyes. Scott recognizes it easily because, until a few months ago, he saw it every time he looked in the mirror. That same thirst for acceptance. It's like living near a bakery, but never eating any bread. Every day you walk the streets, the smell of it in your nose, your stomach growling, but no matter how many corners you turn, you can never enter the actual store. The art market, like the stock market, is based on the perception of value. A painting is worth whatever someone is willing to pay, and that number is influenced by the perception of the artist's importance, their currency. To be a famous artist whose paintings sell for top dollar, either you have to already be a famous artist whose paintings sell for top dollar, or someone has to anoint you as such. And the person who anoints artists more and more these days is Layla Mueller. She comes in wearing black jeans and a pre-wrinkled silk blouse, a brown-eyed blonde, barefoot, holding an electronic cigarette.
"There they are," she says brightly.
Magnus stands, holds out his hand. "I'm Magnus, Kitty's friend." She nods, but doesn't shake. After a moment, he lowers his hand. Layla sits on the sofa next to Scott.
"Can I tell you something weird?" she asks Scott.
I flew to Cannes in May with one of your pilots. The older one, I'm pretty sure.
James Melody, he says, having memorized the names of the dead. She makes a face, holy shit, right? Then nods, touches his shoulder.
Does it hurt?
What?
Your arm.
He moves it for her in its new sling. It's okay, he says.
And that little boy, oh my God, so brave. And then, can you believe? I just saw a thing about the daughter's kidnapping, which, can you imagine?
Scott blinks. Kidnapping? He says.
You don't know,
she says with what seems like real shock.
Yeah, the boy's sister back when she was little. Apparently, someone broke into their house and took her. She was gone for like a week, and now, I mean, to survive something like that and then die so horribly, you couldn't make this stuff up.
Scott nods, feeling bone-tired all of a sudden. Tragedy is drama you can't bear to relive.
I want to throw a party in your honor, she tells him. The hero of the art world.
No, says Scott. Thank you.
Oh, don't be like that, she says. Everybody's talking, and not just about the rescue. I saw slides of your new work, the disaster series, and I love it.
Magnus claps his hands together suddenly at great volume. They turn and look at him.
Sorry, he says, but I told you, didn't I tell you? Feckin' brilliant.
Layla draws on her electronic cigarette. This is what the future looks like, Scott thinks. We smoke technology now.
Can you,
she says,
if it's okay, what happened?
To the plane? It crashed. She nods, her eyes sober.
Have you talked about it yet? To a therapist, or...
Scott thinks about that. A therapist.
Because, says Layla, you'd love my guy. He's in Tribeca. Dr. Vandersloos. He's Dutch.
Scott pictures a bearded man in an office, Kleenex on every table. The cab didn't come, says Scott. So I had to take the bus. She looks puzzled for a moment, then realizes he's sharing a memory with her and leans forward. Scott tells her he remembers his duffel bag by the door, faded green canvas, threadbare in places, remembers pacing, looking for headlights through the window, old milky glass, remembers his watch, the minute hands moving. His duffel held clothes, sure, but mostly it was full of slides, pictures of his work, the new work, hope, his future. Tomorrow it would begin. He'd meet Michelle at her office, and they'd review their submission list. His plan was to stay 3 days. There was a party Michelle said he had to go to, a breakfast. But first, the cab had to come. First, he had to get to the airfield and get on a private plane. Why had he agreed to that? The pressure of it, to travel with strangers, rich strangers, to have to make conversation, discuss his work, or, conversely, be ignored, treated like he didn't matter, which he didn't. He was a 47-year-old man who had failed at life. No career, never married, no close friends or girlfriends. Hell, he couldn't even handle a 4-legged dog. Was that why he had worked so hard these last few weeks, photographing his work, building a portfolio, to try to erase the failure? But the taxi never showed, and in the end he grabbed his bag and ran to the bus stop, heart beating fast, sweating from the thick August air. He got there just as the bus was pulling in, a long rectangle of windows lit blue-white against the dark. And how he climbed on, smiling at the driver, out of breath. He sat in the back, watching teenagers neck, oblivious to the domestic houseworkers riding beside them in tired silence. His heart rate slowed, but his blood still felt like it was racing. This was it. His second chance. The work was there. It was good. He knew that. But was he? What if he couldn't handle a comeback? What if they gave him another chance and he choked? Could he really come back from the place he was? Napoleon in Elba, a beaten man licking his wounds? Did he even want to, deep down? Life was good here. Simple. To wake in the morning and walk on the beach. To feed the dog scraps from the table and scratch her floppy ears. To paint. Simply to paint. With no greater goal. But this way, he could be somebody. Make his mark. Except, wasn't he somebody already? The dog thought so. The dog looked at Scott like he was the best man who ever lived. They went to the farmer's market together and watched the women in yoga pants. He liked his life. He did. So why was he trying so hard to change it? "When I got off the bus," he tells Layla, "I had to run. They were going to close the airplane doors, right? And, you know, there was a part of me that wanted that. To get there and find the plane was already gone. Because then I'd have to get up early and take the ferry like anyone else." He doesn't look up, but he can feel them both looking at him. "But the door was open. I made it." She nods, her eyes wide, and touches his arm.
"Amazing," she says,
though what she means isn't clear. Is she speaking of the fact that Scott nearly missed the fateful flight, or the fact that he didn't? Scott looks up at Layla, feeling self-conscious, like a small bird that has just sung for its supper and now waits for the seed. "Look," says Scott, "it's very nice of you to see me, to want to throw me a party, but I can't handle that right now. I just need a place to think and rest." She smiles, nods. He has given her something no one else has, insight, details. She is part of the story now, his confidant.
"You'll stay here, of course," she says. "There's a guest apartment on the third floor. You'd have your own entrance."
"Thank you," he says. "That's very, and I don't want to be blunt, but I feel like I should ask. What's in it for you?" She takes a hit off her e-cigarette, exhales vapor.
"Sweetie, don't turn it into some kind of thing. I've got the room. I'm impressed with you and your work, and you need a place to be. Why can't it be simple?"
Scott nods. There is no tension in him, no desire for confrontation. He just wants to know. "Oh, I'm not saying it's complicated. You want a secret, maybe, or a story to tell at cocktail parties. I'm just asking so there's no confusion." For a moment, she looks surprised. People don't usually talk to her this way. Then she laughs.
"I like finding people," she says. "And the other thing is, fuck this 24-hour news cycle, this people-eater. Just wait. They're all on your side now, but then they turn. My mom went through it when my dad left her. It was all over the tabloids, and then when my sister had that problem with Vicodin, and last year I had that thing when Tony killed himself, and just because I showed his work, they painted this whole picture of us, how I was like a gateway drug or something."
She holds his eye, Magnus forgotten on the other sofa, waiting for his chance to shine. "Okay," says Scott after a moment. "Thank you. I just need... they're outside my house. All those cameras, and... I don't know what to say other than... I went for a swim." Her phone bloops. She takes it out, looks, then looks at Scott, and there's something on her face that makes him shrink inside. "What?" he says. She flips her phone around and shows him the Twitter app. He leans forward, squinting at a row of colorful rectangles, tiny faces, at symbols, emojis, photo boxes, without a hint of comprehension. "I'm not sure what I'm looking at," he says.
"They found bodies."
Ben Kipling, February 10th, 1963, to August 23rd, 2015. Sarah Kipling, March 1st, 1965, to August 23rd, 2015.
"People use the word money like it's an object, a noun, which is, that's just ignorance."
Ben Kipling stood at a tall porcelain urinal in the wood-paneled bathroom of Sopresi. He was talking to Greg Hoover, who stood beside him, swaying, pissing against the concave sheen that shielded his dick from view, speckles of piss drizzling down on his $600 tasseled loafers.
"Money is the black vacuum of space," Ben continued.
"The what?"
"The black... it's an easement, yeah? A lubricant."
"Now you're talking, my..."
"But that's not..."
Kipling shook his dick, zipped. He went to the sink, put his hand under the soap dispenser, and waited for the laser to sense his warmth and spritz foam into his palm. And waited, and waited.
"It's friction, right?" he said without pausing. "This life of ours. The things we do and are done to us, just getting through the day."
He made increasingly insistent circular gestures under the sensor. Nothing.
"The job, the wife, traffic, bills, whatever."
He raised and lowered his hand, looking for the mechanical sweet spot. Nothing.
"Come on with this fucking thing already."
Kipling gave up, moved to the next sink as Hoover stumbled over to a third.
"I talked to Lance the other day," Hoover started. "Hold on. I'm not... friction, I'm saying. Drag."
This time, when he put his hand under the sensor, foam fell gently into his hand. Kipling slumped with relief, rubbed them together.
"The pressure brought to bear on a man just getting out of bed in the morning," he said. "Money is the cure. It's a friction reducer."
He moved his hands under the water faucet, blindly expecting, once more, the sensor to do its job and send a signal to the switch that turns on the tap. Nothing.
"The more money you have, God damn it, the more..."
Enraged, he gave up entirely, shaking soap from his hands onto the floor, let someone else clean it up, and moved to the paper towel dispenser, saw it too was operated by a sensor, and didn't even make the attempt, choosing instead to wipe his hands on his $1,100 suit pants.
"Money you have, do you see what I'm... it alleviates the drag. Think of the slum rats in Mumbai crawling around in the muck versus, like, Bill Gates, literally on top of the world. Until, ultimately, you have so much dough your whole life is effortless. Like an astronaut floating free in the black vacuum of space."
Hands clean and dry, finally, he turned and saw Hoover has had zero trouble with any of the sensors, soap, water, paper towels. He tore off more sheets than he needed, dried his hands vigorously.
"Sure, okay," he said. "But what I'm saying is, I talked to Lance the other day, and he used a lot of words I really didn't like." "Like what? Alimony? Ha ha. No. Like FBI, for one."
A certain unpleasant clenching sensation hit Kipling right around the sphincter.
"Which is," he said, "obviously, not a word."
"Huh?
It's a... never mind. Why the fuck is Lance talking about the FBI?
"He's hearing things," Hoover said.
"What kind of things?" I asked. "But he won't go into it on the phone. We had to meet in a park. At 2 o'clock in the goddamn afternoon, like the great unemployed."
Kipling, nervous suddenly, went over and checked under the stall doors to make sure there were no other designer suit types crapping in silence.
"Are they... did he say we should be..."
"No, but he may as well have. You know what I...
because why else would he... especially when... especially because if you think of the trouble he could get in..." "Okay, okay. Not so..."
He couldn't remember suddenly if he'd checked under the last stall, checked it again, straightened.
"Let's table this," he said. "I want to hear it, obviously, but we need to finish with these guys, not leave them hanging."
"Sure, but what if they're..."
"What if they're what?" said Kipling, the scotches working like a time delay on a 1940s long-distance phone call.
Hoover finished the sentence with his eyebrows.
"These guys?" said Kipling. "What are you? They came from Gilly."
"That doesn't mean... shit, Ben. Anyone can be got to."
"Got to? Is that... are we in the parallax view suddenly and no one bothered to..."
Hoover worked the wet wad of paper like it was a ball of dough, kneading and squeezing.
"It's a problem, Ben. That's all I'm... a major fucking... I know. We need to... you can't just... I won't. Don't be such a girl."
Kipling went to the door, pushed it open. Behind him, Hoover balled up his wet paper towel and fired it at the garbage can. It went in clean.
"Still got it," he said.
As he approached the table, Kipling saw that Tabitha was doing her job. She was lubricating the clients with booze and telling the men, two Swiss investment bankers vetted and referred by Bill Gilliam, a senior partner at the law firm that handles all their deals, inappropriate stories about men she blew in college. It was 2:30 on a Wednesday. They'd been at this restaurant since noon, drinking top-shelf scotch and eating $50 steaks. It was the kind of restaurant men in suits go to complain that their pools are too hot. Among the five of them, there was a net worth of almost $1 billion. Kipling himself was worth $300 million on paper, most of it tied up in the market, but there was also real estate and offshore accounts. Money for a rainy day. Cash the U.S. government couldn't track. Ben had become, at age 52, the type of man who said, "Let's take the boat out this weekend." His kitchen could be used as backup if the power ever went out at Le Cirque. There was an 8-burner Viking range with grill and griddle. Every morning he rose to find half a dozen onion bagels laid out on a tray with coffee and fresh-squeezed orange juice, along with all 4 papers, Financial Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Post, and The Daily News. When you opened the fridge at the Kiplings, it was like a farmer's market. Sarah insisted they eat only organic produce. There was a separate wine fridge with 15 bottles of champagne on ice at all times, in case a New Year's Eve party broke out unexpectedly. Ben's closet was like a Prada showroom. Wandering from room to room, one wouldn't be wrong to assume that Ben Kipling rubbed an urn one day and a genie popped out, and now all he had to do was say, "I need new socks," out loud anywhere in his apartment, and the next morning a dozen pairs would appear out of fucking nowhere. Except in this case, the genie was a 47-year-old house manager named Mikhail, who majored in hospitality at Cornell and had been with them since they moved into the 10-bedroom estate in Connecticut. The TV over the bar was showing highlights from the Red Sox game last night, sportscasters running the odds of Dworkin breaking the single-season hit record. Right now, the man was on a 15-game hitting streak. Unstoppable was a word they used, the hard consonants of it following Ben to his seat. In 40 minutes, he'd head back to the office and sleep off the meat and the booze on his sofa. Then at 6, the driver would take him up the parkway to Greenwich, where Sarah would have something on the table, takeout from Alessandro's, probably. Or no, wait, shit. They've got that dinner tonight with Jenny's fiancé's parents. A meet-and-greet kind of thing. Where were they doing that again? Someplace in the city? It's got to be in his calendar, probably written in red like a twice-prolonged appointment for a barium enema. Ben could picture them now, Mr. and Mrs. Comstock, he the portly dentist, his wife with too much lipstick in from Long Island. Did you take the Grand Central or the BQE? And Jenny would sit there with Don or Ron or whatever her fiancé's name is, holding hands and telling stories about how she and her parents always summer on the vineyard, without realizing how privileged and obnoxious that sounds. Not that Ben was one to talk. This morning he'd found himself debating the estate tax with his personal trainer, and he'd said, "Well, look, Jerry, wait till you've got $100 million-plus in mixed assets that the government wants to tax twice, and see if you still feel the same." Kipling sat, exhausted suddenly, and picked up his napkin reflexively, even though he was done eating. He dropped it into his lap, caught the waiter's eye, and pointed to his glass. "Another one," he said with his eyes.
"I was just telling Jürgen," said Tabitha, "about that meeting we had in Berlin. Remember when the guy with the John Waters mustache got so mad he took off his tie and tried to strangle Greg?"
"For $50 million, I would have let him," said Kipling. "Except it turned out the fucking guy was broke."
The Swiss smiled patiently. They had zero interest in gossip. Nor did it seem that Tabitha's exaggerated cleavage was having its usual effect. Could be they're queer, thought Kipling, with zero moral judgment, just a computer recording facts. He chewed the inside of his cheek, thinking. What Hoover said to him in the men's room was ricocheting around in his brain like a bullet that had missed its target, then took an unlucky hop off the pavement. What did he know about these guys, really? They'd come recommended from a reliable source, but how reliable was anyone when you get right down to it? Could they be FBI, these boys? OFAC? Their Swiss accents were good, but maybe not great. Kipling had a sudden impulse to drop cash on the table and walk away. He tamped it down, because if he was wrong, it was a hell of a lot of money to walk away from, and Ben Kipling wasn't a man to walk away from, what did the Swiss say? Potentially $1 billion in hard-to-convert currency? Fuck it, Ben decided. If you're not going to retreat, then you've got to charge. He opened his mouth and gave them the hard sell without getting too specific. No hot phrases that could be used against him in court. So okay with the small talk, he said. We all know what we're doing here. The same thing cavemen did in the age of the dinosaur, sizing each other up, seeing who you can trust. What's a handshake, after all, except a socially acceptable way to make sure the other guy doesn't have a knife behind his back? He smiled at them. They looked back, unsmiling but engaged. This was the moment they cared about, if they were who they said they were. The deal. The waiter brought Kipling his scotch, put it on the table. By habit, Ben moved it deeper toward the center of the table. He was a hand talker, and had spilled his fair share of cocktails in the middle of a good monologue. "You have a problem," he said. "You've got foreign currency you need to invest in the open market, but our government won't let you. Why? Because at some point that money found its way to a region they keep on a list in some federal building in D.C. As if the money itself had a point of view. But you and me, we know that money is money. The dollar a black guy in Harlem uses to buy crack with today is the same dollar a suburban housewife uses to buy hamburger helper tomorrow, or that Uncle Sam uses to buy weapons systems from McDonnell Douglas on Thursday." Ben watched plays of the day on the television, a string of towering home runs, shoestring catches, and baseline rundowns. It was more than a passing interest. Ben was an encyclopedia of arcane baseball figures. It was a lifelong passion, one that had taught him, coincidentally, the value of a dollar. 10-year-old Benny Kipling had the premier bubblegum card collection in all of Sheepshead Bay. He dreamed one day of playing center field for the Mets, and every year tried out for Little League, but he was small for his age and slow on the base path and couldn't hit the ball out of the infield. So he collected baseball cards instead, studying the market closely, exploiting the amateur mindset of schoolmates who focused only on players they liked, tracking rare cards and playing the rise and fall of each player. Every morning, Benny would read the obituaries, looking for signs that the recently deceased were baseball fans, and then he'd call the widows, saying he knew their husbands, or fathers, from the trading card circuit, and how so-and-so had been a mentor to him. He never asked for the decedent's collection outright, just played up his saddest little boy voice. It worked every time. On more than one occasion, he took the subway into the city to collect a once-prized box of baseball nostalgia. "We come to you, Mr. Kipling," said Jürgen, the dark-haired Aryan in the cotton-weight suit, "because we hear good things. Obviously, these are sensitive subjects, but my colleagues agree you are a straight man, that complications do not arrive, additional expenses. The clients we represent, well, these are not people who appreciate complications or attempts to take advantage." "And who is that again?" said Hoover, sweating at the brows. "Say without saying, if you can, just so we're all clear." The Swiss said nothing. They, too, feared a trap. "The deal we make is a deal we keep," said Kipling. "Doesn't matter who's on the other side. I can't tell you exactly how we do what we do. That's our proprietary advantage, right? But what I will say is, accounts are opened. Accounts that cannot be connected back to you. After that, the money you invest with my firm gets a new pedigree and is treated like any other money. It goes in dirty and comes out clean. Simple."
"And how does it
work? Well, if we agree now in principle to move forward with this thing, Then colleagues of mine will come to Geneva and help you set up the systems you'll need using a proprietary software package. My operative will then stay on site to monitor your investments and navigate the daily password and IP address changes. He doesn't need a fancy office. In fact, the less attention he draws, the better. Put him in a men's room stall or in the basement next to the boiler. The men thought about this. While they did, Kipling grabbed a passing waiter and handed him his black Amex card. Look, he said, pirates used to bury treasure in the sand and then row away, and the minute they left, in my opinion, they were broke, because money in a box? Outside the window, he watched a group of men in dark suits approach the front door. In an instant, Ben saw the whole thing unravel. They would come in fast, guns out, wallets high, a sting operation, like a tiger trap in the jungle. Ben saw himself flipped on his belly, cuffed, his summer suit stained beyond repair, dirty footprints on his back. But the men kept walking. The moment passed. Kipling breathed again, finished his scotch in a single draft. Money you can't use has no value. He sized them up, the men from Geneva, no bigger or smaller than a dozen other men he had sat across from, making this same pitch. They were fish to be caught on a hook, women to be flattered and seduced. FBI or no FBI, Ben Kipling was a money magnet. He had a quality that couldn't be put in writing. Rich people looked at him and saw a vault with two doors. They visualized their money going in one door and coming out the other, multiplied. A sure thing. He slid his chair back, buttoning his jacket. I like you guys, he said. I trust you, and I don't say that to just anyone. My feeling is we should do this, but in the end, it's up to you. He stood. Tabitha and Greg are going to stay behind. Get your details. It was a pleasure. The Swiss stood, shook his hand. Ben Kipling walked away from them, the front door opening before him as he exited. His car was at the curb, back door open, driver standing at attention, and he slid inside without slowing. The black vacuum of space. Across town, a yellow cab pulled up in front of the Whitney Museum. The driver had been born in Kathmandu, had stolen down into Michigan from Saskatchewan, paying a smuggler $600 for fake ID. He slept in an apartment now with 14 other people, sent most of his pay overseas in the hope of one day bringing his wife and boys over on a plane. The woman in back, on the other hand, who told him to keep the change from a 20, lived in Greenwich, Connecticut, and owned 19 televisions she didn't watch. Once upon a time, she was a doctor's daughter in Brookline, Massachusetts, a girl who grew up riding horses and got a nose job for her 16th birthday. Everyone is from someplace. We all have stories, our lives unfolding along crooked lines, colliding in unexpected ways. Sarah Kipling turned 50 in March. There was a surprise party in the Cayman Islands. Ben picked her up in a limo to go to Tavern on the Green, she thought, but took her out to Teterboro instead. 5 hours later, she was sipping rum punch with her toes in the sand. Now, outside the Whitney, she climbed out of a cab. She was meeting her daughter Jenny, 26, to tour the biennial and get a quick download on her fiancé's parents before the dinner. This wasn't so much for Sarah's benefit, because she could talk to anyone, as it was for Ben's. Her husband had a hard time with conversations that weren't about money. Or maybe that wasn't it exactly. Maybe it was that he had a hard time talking to people who didn't have money. Not that he was aloof. It was just that he'd forgotten what it was like to have a mortgage or a car loan. What it was to be getting by. To go to a store and have to check the price of something before you buy it. And this could make him seem vulgar and aloof. Sarah loathed the feeling she got in those moments, watching her husband embarrass himself and her. There was no other word for it in her mind. As his wife, she was irrevocably tied to him. His opinions were her opinions. They reflected poorly on her, perhaps not because she held them exactly, but because by choosing Ben, by sticking with him, She showed herself, in the eyes of others, to be a poor judge of character. Though she grew up with money, Sarah knew that the last thing you did was talk about it. This was the difference between new money and old. Old money kids were the ones in college with bedhead and moth-hole sweaters. You found them in the cafeteria, borrowing lunch money and eating off their friends' plates. They passed as poor, affecting a disposition that they were beyond money, as if one of the riches wealth had bought them was the right never to think about money again. In this way, they floated through the real world the way that child prodigies stumbled through the daily travails of human existence, heads in the clouds, forgetting to wear socks, their shirts misbuttoned. This made her husband's tone deafness on the subject of money, his need to constantly remind others how much they had, feel so gauche, so rude. As a result, it had become her tired mission in life to soften his edges, to educate him on how to get rich without becoming tacky. So, Jenny would fill her in about her future in-laws, and Sarah would send Ben a text. You can talk about politics with the husband. He votes Republican. Or sports. Jets fan. The wife went to Italy last year with her book group. Travel? Reading? They have a son with Down syndrome in an institution, so no retard jokes. Sarah had tried to get Ben to show more of an interest in people, to be more open to new experiences. They'd gone to counseling about it for 2 weeks before Ben told her he'd rather cut off his ears than listen to that woman for another day. But eventually she'd done what most wives do and just gave up. So now it was she who had to make the extra effort to ensure that social engagements went well. Jenny was waiting for her outside the main entrance. She had on flared slacks and a T-shirt, with her hair in the kind of beret the girls were wearing these days. "Mom," she called when Sarah didn't see her right away. "Sorry," her mother said. "My eyes are shot. Your father keeps telling me to go to the eye doctor, but who has the time?" They hugged briefly, efficiently, then moved inside. "I got here early, so I got us tickets," said Jenny. Sarah tried to shove a $100 bill in her hand.
"Mom, don't be silly. I'm happy to pay."
"For a cab later," her mother said, jabbing the bill at her like a flyer to a mattress store they shoved at you on the street. But Jenny turned away and handed their tickets to the docent, and Sarah was forced to put the bill back in her wallet.
"I heard the best stuff is upstairs," said Jenny, "so maybe we should start at the top."
"Whatever you want, dear."
They waited for the elevator and rode up in silence. Behind them, a Latin family talked in animated Spanish, the woman berating her husband. Sarah had studied Spanish in high school, though she hadn't kept up. She recognized the words for motorcycle and babysitter, and it was clear from the exchange that something extramarital may have occurred. At their feet, two young children played games on handheld devices, their faces lit and eerie blue.
"Shane's nervous about tonight," Jenny said after they exited the elevator. "It's so cute."
"The first time I met your father's parents, I threw up," Sarah told her.
"Really?"
"Yes, but I think it might have been the clam chowder I had at lunch."
"Oh, Mom," said Jenny, smiling. "You're so funny."
Jenny always told her friends that her mother was slightly batty. Sarah knew it, or sensed it on some level, and she was, what's the word, a little absent-minded, a little, well, sometimes she made unique connections in her head. And didn't Robin Williams have the same quality? Or other, you know, innovative thinkers?
"So now you're Robin Williams?" Ben would say.
"Well, he doesn't have to be nervous," said Sarah. "We don't bite."
"Class is a real thing," Jenny told her. "I mean, again, the divide, you know, rich people and, I mean, Shane's parents aren't poor, but..."
"It's dinner at Bali, not class warfare. And besides, we're not that rich."
"When was the last time you flew commercial?"
"Last winter to Aspen."
Her daughter made a sound as if to say, "Do you hear yourself?"
"We're not billionaires, dear. This is Manhattan, you know. Some of the parties we go to, I feel like the help."
"You own a yacht. It's not a..."
"It's a sailboat. and I told your father not to buy it. Is that who we are now? I said. Boat people? But you know him when he gets an idea. Whatever. The point is, he's nervous, so will you please, I don't know, keep it light.
You're talking to the woman who charmed a Swedish prince, and boy was he a sourpuss.
With this, they entered the main gallery space. Oversized canvases lined the walls, each a gesture of will, thoughts and ideas reduced to lines and color. Sarah tried to let her daily brain go, to quiet the constant natter of thoughts, the chronic to-do list of modern life, but it was hard. The more you had, the more you worried. That was what she'd decided. When Jenny was born, they'd lived in a two-bedroom apartment on the Upper West Side. Ben earned $80,000 a year as a runner at the exchange. But he was handsome and good at making people laugh, and he knew how to seize an opportunity. So 2 years later, he had graduated to trader and was pulling in four times that amount. They'd moved east to a condo in the 60s and started buying groceries at Citarella. Before motherhood, Sarah had worked in advertising, and after Jenny was in preschool, she'd flirted with the idea of going back to it, but she couldn't stomach the idea of a nanny raising her daughter while she was at work. So, though she felt like she was giving up a piece of her soul, she'd stayed home and made lunch and changed diapers and waited for her husband to come home and do his share. Her mother had encouraged her to do it, becoming, as her mother described it, a lady of leisure. But Sarah didn't do well with unstructured time, possibly because her mind was so unstructured. And so she'd become a woman of lists, a woman with multiple calendars who left sticky notes on the inside of their front door. She was the kind of person who needed reminding, who would forget a phone number the second after someone recited it to her. She'd known it was bad when her 3-year-old daughter started reminding her of things, even went to see a neurologist who'd found nothing physically wrong with her brain and suggested Ritalin, suggesting she had ADHD. But Sarah hated pills and worried they would turn her into a different person, so she'd gone back to her lists, to her calendars and alarms. On nights that Ben had worked late, which became increasingly frequent, she couldn't help but think of her mother in the kitchen when Sarah was young, washing up after dinner, supervising the end-of-day arts and crafts while packing lunches for the next day. Was this the cycle of motherhood? The constant return? Someone had told her once that mothers existed to blunt the existential loneliness of being a person. If that was true, then her biggest maternal responsibility was simply companionship. You bring a child into this fractious, chaotic world out of the heat of your womb, and then spend the next 10 years walking beside them while they figure out how to be a person. Fathers, on the other hand, were there to toughen children up, to say, walk it off, when mothers would hold them if they fell. Mothers were the carrot, fathers were the stick. And so Sarah had found herself in her own kitchen on East 63rd Street, packing preschool lunches and reading picture books during warm baths, her body and her daughter's body one and the same. On those nights when she'd fall asleep alone, Sarah would bring Jenny into bed with her, reading books and talking until they both nodded off, intertwined. This would be how Ben found them when he came home, smelling of booze, his tie askew, kicking his shoes off noisily. "Our my girls," he'd say. His girls, as if they were both his daughter. But he said the words with love, his face brightening, as if this was his reward for a long day, the faces of the women he loved looking up at him with sleepy eyes from the comfort of the family bed. "I like this one," said Jenny, now a woman in her 20s, 5 years from children of her own. They'd managed to stay close through her divisive teen years, despite all odds. Jenny never was one for drama. The worst you could say now was that she didn't respect her mom the way she used to, the curse of the modern woman. You stay home and raise daughters who grow up and get jobs and then feel pity for you, their stay-at-home mothers. Beside her, Jenny was going on about Shane's parents. Dad fixed up old cars. Mom liked to do charity work for their church, and Sarah tried to focus, listening for red flags, things Ben would need to know, but her mind wandered. It struck her that she could buy any of the art in this room. What was the most these pieces by young artists could cost? A few hundred thousand? A million? On the Upper West Side, they'd lived on the third floor. The condo on East 63rd was on the ninth. Now they owned a penthouse loft in Tribeca, 53 stories up. And though the house in Connecticut was only two floors, the zip code itself made it a space station of sorts. The farmers at the Saturday Farmers Market were the new breed of hipster artisans, championing the return of heirloom apples and the lost art of basket weaving. The things Sarah called problems now were wholly elective.
There are no first-class seats left on our flight. The sailboat is leaking, etc.
Actual struggle? They'd come to turn off the gas. Your kid was knifed at school. The car's been repossessed. Had become a thing of the past. And all of this left Sarah to wonder, now that Jenny was grown, now that their wealth had exceeded their needs by a factor of 600, what was the point? Her parents had money, sure, but not this much. Enough to join the nicest country club, to buy a 6-bedroom home and drive the latest cars, enough to retire with a few million in the bank. But this, hundreds of millions in clean currency stashed in the Caymans, it was beyond the boundaries of old money. Beyond even the boundaries of what was once considered new. Modern wealth was something else entirely. And these days, in the unstructured hours of her life, Sarah wondered, was she staying alive now just to move money around? I shop, therefore I am.
When Ben got back to the office, he found two men waiting for him. They sat in the outer office reading magazines while Darlene typed nervously on her computer. Ben could tell from their suits, off the rack, that they were government. He almost spun on his heels and walked out, but he didn't. The truth was, he had, on the advice of his lawyer, a packed bag in a storage unit and a few untraceable millions offshore.
"Mr. Kipling," said Darlene too loudly, standing, "these gentlemen are here to see you."
The men put down their magazines, stood. One was tall and square-jawed. The other had a dark mole under his left eye.
"Mr. Kipling," said Square-jaw, "I'm Jordan Bewes from the Treasury Department. This is my colleague, Agent Hex." "Ben Kipling."
Kipling forced himself to shake their hands.
"What's this about?"
he asked as casually as he could.
"We'll do that, sir," said Hex. "But let's do it in private."
"Of course. Whatever I can do to help. Come on back."
He turned to lead them into his office, caught Darlene's eye.
"Get Barney Culpepper up here."
He led the agents into his corner office. They were 86 stories up, but the tempered glass shielded them from the elements, creating a hermetic seal, a sense that one was in a dirigible, floating high above it all.
"Can I offer you anything?" he said. "Pellegrino?"
"We're fine," said Bewes.
Kipling went to the sofa, dropped into the corner by the window. He had decided he would act like a man with nothing to fear. There was a bowl of pistachios on the sideboard. He took a nut, cracked it, ate the meat.
"Sit, please."
The men had to turn the guest chairs to face the sofa. They sat awkwardly.
"Mr. Kipling," said Bewes, "we're from the Office of Foreign Assets Control. Are you familiar with that?"
"I've heard of it, but honestly, they don't keep me around for my logistical know-how. I'm more the creative thinker type."
"We're an arm of the Treasury Department."
"I got that part."
"Well, we're here to make sure that American businesses and investment firms don't do business with countries our government has deemed off-limits. And, well, your firm has come to our attention."
"By off-limits, you mean..."
"Sanctioned," said Hex. "We're referring to countries like Iran and North Korea. Countries that fund terrorism."
"Their money's bad," said Hex. "And we don't want it here."
Ben smiled, showing them his perfectly capped teeth.
The countries are bad, that's for sure. But the money? Well, money's a tool, gentlemen. It's neither good nor bad. Okay, sir, let me back up. You've heard of the law, yes? Which law? No, I'm saying, you know we have this thing called laws in this country.
Mr. Bewes, don't patronize me.
I'm just trying to find a language we both understand, said Bewes. The point is, we suspect your firm is laundering money for, well, shit, just about everyone. And we're here to let you know we're watching.
At this, the door opened and Barney Culpepper came in. Wearing blue and white seersucker, Barney was everything you'd want in a corporate attorney. Aggressive, blue-blooded, the son of the former U.S. ambassador to China. His father was pals with three presidents. Right now, Barney had a red and white candy cane in his mouth, even though it was August. Seeing him, Kipling felt a wave of relief, like a kid called to the principal's office who rebounds when his dad arrives.
Gentlemen, said Ben, this is Mr. Culpepper, the firm's in-house counsel.
This is a casual conversation, said Hex. No need for lawyers.
Culpepper didn't bother shaking hands. He leaned his backside against the sideboard.
Ask me about the candy, he said.
Pardon?
Said Hex.
The candy.
Ask me about it.
Hex and Bewes exchanged a look as if to say, I don't want to. You do it. Finally, Bewes shrugged.
What's with the...
Culpepper took the candy cane out of his mouth, showed it to them. When my assistant said two agents from Treasury were here, all I could think was, it must be fucking Christmas.
Very funny, mister. Because I know my old racquetball buddy Leroy Abel. You know him, right?
He's the Secretary of the Treasury.
Exactly. Well, I know my old racquetball buddy Leroy wouldn't send agents down here without calling me first. And since he didn't call...
This, said Hex, is more of a courtesy call.
Like where you bring over cookies and say welcome to the neighborhood?
Culpepper looks at Kipling.
Are there cookies? Did I miss that?
No cookies, says Ben.
Bewes smiles.
You want cookies?
No, says Culpepper. It's just, when your friend said a courtesy call, I thought...
Bewes and Hex exchange a look. Stand.
Nobody's above the law, says Bewes.
Who said anything?
Says Culpepper.
I thought we were talking about dessert.
Bewes buttons his jacket, smiling. A guy with a winning hand.
A case is being built. Months.
Years. Sanctioned at the highest level.
And you want to talk about evidence?
How about you'd need two tractor trailers to haul it all to court?
File a suit, said Culpepper.
Show a warrant. We'll respond.
When the time comes, said Hex.
Assuming you guys aren't parking cars in Queens after I make a phone call, said Culpepper, chewing on his candy cane.
Hey, said Bewes, I'm from the Bronx. You want to call a guy out? Call him out. But make sure you know what you're buying.
It's so cute, said Culpepper, that you think it matters the size of your dick. 'Cause, son, when I fuck someone, I use my whole arm. He showed them the arm, and the hand attached to it, at the end of which a single finger was raised in salute. Bewes laughed.
You know how some days you come to work and it's a drag, he said? Well, this is going to be fun.
That's what they all say, said Culpepper, until it goes in past the elbow.
That night at dinner, Ben was distracted. He reviewed his conversation with Culpepper in his head.
It's nothing, Culpepper had said, dropping his candy cane in the trash after the agents left. They're traffic cops writing bullshit tickets at the end of the month, trying to get their quotas up.
They said months, Ben responded. Years.
Look at what happened to HSBC, a fucking wrist slap. You know why? Because if they gave them the full extent of the law, they'd have had to take their banking license. And we all know that's not going to happen. They're too big to jail.
You're calling a billion-dollar fine a wrist slap?
It's walking around money, a few months' profits. You know that better than anyone.
But Ben wasn't so sure. Something about the way the agents carried themselves. They were cocky, like they knew they had the high card.
We need to close ranks, he'd said. Anyone who knows anything.
Already done?
Do you know the level of non-disclosure paperwork you have to sign to even work the front desk here? It's Fort fucking Knox. I'm not going to jail.
Jesus, don't be such a pussy. Don't you get it? There is no jail. Remember the LIBOR scandal? A conspiracy worth trillions with a T. A reporter says to the assistant attorney general, this is a bank that has broken the law before, so why not be tougher? The assistant attorney general says, I don't know what tougher means.
They came to my office, Ben had said.
They took an elevator ride. Two guys. If they really had something, it'd be hundreds of guys, and they'd walk out with a lot more than their dicks in their hands.
And yet, sitting in a corner booth with Sarah and Jenny and her fiancé's family, Ben couldn't help but wonder if that was really all they'd walked out with. Ben wished he had videotape of the meeting so he could watch his own face, see how much he'd given away. His poker face was usually top-notch, but in that room he'd felt off his game. Did it come through in the tension around his mouth? A crinkle in his eyes?
Ben? Said Sarah, shaking his arm.
From the look on her face, it was clear a question has been thrown his way.
Huh? He said. Oh, sorry. I didn't catch that. It's pretty loud in here.
He said this even though the place was dead quiet, just a few blue hairs whispering into their soup.
I said, we still think real estate is the way to go, money-wise, said Bert or Carl or whatever Shane's father's name was, and then I asked your opinion.
Depends on the real estate, said Ben, sliding out of the banquette. But my advice after Hurricane Sandy is, if you're buying in Manhattan, pick a high floor.
He excused himself, dodging Sarah's disapproving look, and went outside. He needed some air. On the curb, he bummed a smoke from a late commuter and stood under the restaurant's awning, smoking. A light rain fell, and he watched the taillights sheen on the black macadam.
Got another? Asked a man in a turtleneck, stepping out behind Ben.
Kipling turned, eyed him. A moneyed man in his 40s, but with a nose that had been broken at least once.
Sorry, I bummed this one.
The man in the turtleneck shrugged, stood looking out at the rain.
There's a young lady in the restaurant trying to get your attention, he said.
Ben looked. Jenny was waving at him.
Come back to the table.
He looked away.
My daughter, he said. It's meet the new in-laws night.
Congrats, said the man.
Kipling puffed, nodded.
With boys you worry. Will they ever leave the house, said the man. Find their way. In my day they kicked you to the curb the minute you hit voting age, sometimes before. Adversity. It's the only way to make a man.
That what happened to your nose? Said Kipling.
The man smiled.
You know how on your first day in prison they say find the biggest guy and kick his ass? Well, like anything else, there are consequences.
You've been to prison? Said Kipling,
feeling a tourist's thrill.
Not here. Kiev.
Jesus.
And later in Shanghai, but that was a piece of pie compared.
Are we talking bad luck, or...
The man smiled.
Like an accident? No, man. The world's a dangerous place, but you know that, right?
What?
Said Kipling, feeling a slight premonitory chill.
I said you know the world's a dangerous place. Cause and effect, wrong place, wrong time. You could fill a thimble with the times in human history a good man did a bad thing without thinking.
I didn't catch your name.
How about my Twitter handle? You want to Instagram me?
Kipling dropped his cigarette on the sidewalk. As he did, a black car pulled up to the curb in front of the restaurant and sat, idling.
Nice talking to you, said Ben. Hold on. We're almost through, but not quite.
Kipling tried to get through the door, but the man was in the way, not blocking him exactly, just there.
My wife, said Ben. She's fine, said the man. Probably right now thinking about dessert. Maybe have the meringue. So take a breath. Or take a ride in the car.
Your choice.
Kipling's heart was going a mile a minute. He'd forgotten this feeling existed. What was it? Mortality?
Look, said Ben, I don't know what you think.
You had a visit today. The party police. Senior Buzzkill. I'm being obtuse deliberately.